This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Scarlet by Marissa Meyer. Even in the future, beware of the big bad wolf. Cinder, the cyborg mechanic, returns in the second thrilling installment of the best-selling Lunar Chronicles. She is trying to break out of prison, even though if she succeeds, she'll be the Commonwealth's most wanted fugitive. Halfway around the world, Scarlet Benoit's grandmother is missing. When Scarlet encounters Wolf, a street fighter who may have information about her grandmother's whereabouts, she is loath to trust this stranger, but is inexplicably drawn to him and he to her. As Scarlet and Wolf unravel one mystery, they encounter another when they meet Cinder. Now, all of them must stay one step ahead of the vicious Lunar Queen Lavanna, who will do anything for the handsome Prince Kai to become her husband, her king, her prisoner. Book 1. She did not know that the wolf was a wicked sort of animal, and she was not afraid of him. Chapter 1. Scarlet was descending toward the valley behind the Ryu Tavern when her port screen chimed from the passenger seat, followed by an automated voice. "Comm received from Mademoiselle Scarlet Benoit from the Toulouse Law Enforcement Department of Missing Persons." Heart jumping, she swerved just in time to keep the ship's starboard side from skidding against the stone wall and threw down the brakes before reaching a complete stop. Scarlet killed the engine, already grabbing for the discarded port screen. Its pale blue light glinted off the cockpit's controls. They'd found something. The Toulouse police must have found something. "Except!" she yelled, practically choking the port in her fingers. She expected a vidlink from the detective assigned to her grandmother's case, but all she got was a stream of unembellished text. 28 August 126 TE. Re. Case ID number AIG00155819. Filed on 11 August 126 TE. This communication is to inform Scarlet Benoit of Rio, France, EF, that as of 1542, on 28th of August, 126, the case of missing person Michel Benoit of Rio, France, EF, has been dismissed due to lack of sufficient evidence of violence or nonspecific foul play. Conjecture, person left of own free will and or suicide. Case closed. We thank you for your patronage of our detective services. The comm was followed by a video ad from the police reminding all delivery ship pilots to be safe and wear their harnesses while engines were running. Scarlet stared at the small screen until the words turned into a screaming blur of black and white and the ground seemed to drop out from beneath the ship. The plastic panel on the back of the screen crunched in her tightening grip. "Idiots!" she hissed to the empty ship. The words "case closed" laughed back up at her. She released a guttural scream and slammed the port down on the ship's control panel, hoping to shatter it into pieces of plastic and metal and wire. After 3 solid whaps, the screen only flickered in mild irritation. "You idiots!" She threw the port at the floorboards in front of the passenger seat and slumped back, stringing her curly hair through her fingers. Her harness cut into her chest, subtly strangling, and she released the buckle and kicked open her door at the same time, half falling into the alley's shadows. The grease and whiskey scent from the tavern nearly choked her as she swallowed her breaths, trying to rationalize her way out of the anger. She would go to the police station. It was too late to go now. Tomorrow, then. First thing in the morning, she would be calm and logical, and she would explain to them why their assumptions were wrong. She would make them reopen the case. Scarlet swiped her wrist over the scanner beside the ship's hatch and yanked it up harder than the hydraulics wanted to let it go. She would tell the detective that he had to keep searching. She would make him listen. She would make him understand that her grandma hadn't left of her own free will, and that she most certainly had not killed herself. Half a dozen plastic crates filled with garden vegetables were crammed into the back of the ship, but Scarlet hardly saw them. She was miles away, in Toulouse, planning the conversation in her head, calling on every last persuasion, every ounce of reasoning power she had. Something had happened to her grandmother. Something was wrong. And if the police didn't keep looking, Scarlet was going to take it to court and see that every one of their turnip-head detectives was disbarred and would never work again. And she snatched a gleaming red tomato in each fist, swung on her heels, and pummeled the stone wall with them. The tomatoes splattered, juice and seeds spraying across the piles of garbage that were waiting to go into the compactor. It felt good. Scarlet grabbed another, imagining the detective's doubt when she tried to explain to him that up and disappearing was not normal behavior for her grandma. She pictured the tomatoes bursting all over his smug little. A door swung open, just as the fourth tomato was obliterated. Scarlet froze, already reaching for another, as the tavern's owner draped himself against the door frame. Gil's narrow face was glistening as he took in the slushy orange mess Scarlet had made on the side of his building. Those better not be my tomatoes. She withdrew her hand from the bin and wiped it down on her dirt-stained jeans. She could feel heat emanating from her face, the erratic thumping of her pulse. Gil's swiped the sweat off his almost bald head and glared, his default expression. Well, they weren't yours, she muttered, which was true. They were technically hers until he paid her for them. He grunted. Then I'll only dock 3 univs for having to clean off the mess. Now, if you're done with target practice, maybe you could deign to bring some of that in here. I've been serving wilted lettuce for 2 days. He popped back into the restaurant, leaving the door open. The noise of dishes and laughter spilled out into the alley, bizarre in its normality. Scarlet's world was crashing down around her, and nobody noticed. Her grandmother was missing, and nobody cared. She turned back to the hatch and gripped the edges of the tomato crate, waiting for her heart to stop hammering behind her sternum. The words from the comm still bombarded her thoughts, but they were beginning to clear. The first wave of aggression was left to rot with the smashed tomatoes. When she could take in a breath without her lungs convulsing, she stacked the crate on top of the russet potatoes and heaved them out of the ship. The line cooks ignored Scarlet as she dodged their spitting skillets, making her way to the cool storage room. She shoved the bins onto the shelves that had been labeled in marker, scratched out, and labeled again a dozen times over the years. Bonjour, Scarling. Scarlet turned around, pulling her hair off her clammy neck. Emily was beaming in the doorway, eyes sparkling with a secret, but she pulled back when she saw Scarlet's expression. What? I don't want to talk about it. Slipping past the waitress, she headed back through the kitchen, but Emily made a dismissive noise in the back of her throat and trotted after her. Then don't talk. I'm just glad you're here, she said, latching onto Scarlet's elbow as they ducked back into the alleyway. Because he's back. Despite the angelic blonde curls that surrounded Emily's face, her grin suggested very devilish thoughts. Scarlet pulled away and grabbed a bin of parsnips and radishes, passing them to the waitress. She didn't respond, incapable of caring who he was and why it mattered that he was back. That's great, she said, loading a basket of paper and red onions. You don't remember, do you? Come on, Scar. The street fighter was telling you about the other. Oh, maybe that was Sophia. The street fighter? Scarlet squeezed her eyes shut as a headache began to throb against her forehead. Really, Em? Don't be like that. He's sweet, and he's been here almost every night this week, and he keeps sitting in my section, which definitely means something, don't you think? When Scarlet said nothing, the waitress set the bin down and fished a pack of gum from her apron pocket. He's really very quiet, not like Roland and his crowd. I think he's shy and lonely. She popped a stick into her mouth and offered another to Scarlet. A street fighter who seems shy? Scarlet waved the gum away. Are you listening to yourself? You have to see him to understand. He has these eyes that just... Emily fanned her fingers against her brow, feigning heart stroke. Emily! Jules appeared at the door again. Stop flapping those lips and get in here. Table 4 wants you. He cast a glare at Scarlet, a silent warning that he'd be docking more univs from her fee if she didn't stop distracting his employees, then pulled back inside without waiting for a response. Emily stuck her tongue out at after him. Settling the basket of onions against her hip, Scarlet shut the hatch and brushed past the waitress. Is table for him? No, he's at 9. Emily grumbled, scooping up the load of root vegetables. As they passed back through the steamy kitchen, Emily gasped, Oh, I'm so daft. I've been meaning to come and ask about your grandmère all week. Have you heard anything new? Scarlet clenched her jaw, the words of the calm buzzing like hornets in her head. Case closed. Nothing new, she said, then let their conversation get lost in the chaos of the cooks screaming at each other across the line. Emily followed her as far as the storeroom and dropped off her load. Scarlet busied herself rearranging the baskets before the waitress could say something optimistic. Emily attempted the requisite, "Try not to worry, Scar, she'll be back," before backing away into the tavern. Scarlet's jaw was beginning to ache from gnashing her teeth. Everyone talked about her grandma's disappearance as if she were a stray cat who would meander back home when she got hungry. Don't worry, she'll be back. But she'd been gone for over 2 weeks, just disappeared without sending a comm, without a goodbye, without any warning. She'd even missed Scarlet's 18th birthday, though she'd bought the ingredients for Scarlet's favorite lemon cake the week before. None of the farmhands had seen her go. None of the worker androids had recorded anything suspicious. Her port screen had been left behind, though it offered no clues in its stored comms, calendar, or net history. Her leaving without it was suspicious enough. No one went anywhere without their ports. But that wasn't the worst of it. Not the abandoned port screen or the unmade cake. Scarlet had also found her grandmother's ID chip. Her ID chip, wrapped in cheesecloth, spotted red from her blood, and left like a tiny package on the kitchen counter. The detective said that's what people did when they ran away and didn't want to be found. They cut out their ID chips. He'd said it like he'd just solved the mystery, but Scarlet figured most kidnappers probably knew that trick, too. Chapter 2. Scarlet spotted Jules behind the hot top, ladling bechamel sauce on top of a ham sandwich. She walked around to the other side, yelling to get his attention, and was met with annoyance. I'm done, she said, returning the scowl. Come sign off on the delivery. Gilles shoveled a stack of frits beside the sandwich and slid the plate across the steel counter to her. Run that out to the first booth, and I'll have it ready when you get back. Scarlet bristled. I don't work for you, Gilles. Just be grateful I'm not sending you out to the alley with a scrub brush. He turned his back on her, his white shirt yellowed from years of sweat. Scarlet's fingers twitched with the fantasy of chucking the sandwich at the back of his head and seeing how it compared to the tomatoes. But her grandmother's stern face just as quickly infiltrated the dream. How disappointed she would be to come back home only to find that Scarlett had lost one of their most loyal clients in a fit of temper. Grabbing the plate, Scarlett stormed out of the kitchen and was nearly bowled over by a waiter as soon as the kitchen door swung shut behind her. The Ryu Tavern was not a nice place. The floors were sticky, the furniture was a mismatch of cheap tables and chairs, and the air was saturated with grease. But in a town where drinking and gossiping were the favorite pastimes, it was always busy, especially on Sundays when the local farmhands ignored their crops for a full 24 hours. While she waited for a path to clear through the crowd, Scarlett's attention landed on the net screens behind the bar. All three were broadcasting the same news footage that had filled up the net since the night before. Everyone was talking about the Eastern Commonwealth's annual ball, where the Lunar Queen was a guest of honor, and where a cyborg girl had infiltrated the party, blown up some chandeliers, and tried to assassinate the visiting queen. Or maybe she'd been trying to assassinate the newly coronated emperor. Everyone seemed to have a different theory. The freeze frame on the screens showed a close-up of the girl, with dirt smudges on her face and strands of damp hair pulled from a messy ponytail. It was a mystery how she'd ever been admitted to a royal ball in the first place. "They should have put her out of her misery when she fell on those stairs," said Roland, a tavern regular who looked like he'd been bellied up to the bar since noon. He extended a finger toward the screen and mimed shooting a gun. "I'd have put a bullet right through her head, and good riddance." When a rustle of agreement passed through the nearest patrons, Scarlett rolled her eyes in disgust and shoved toward the first booth. She recognized Emily's handsome street fighter immediately, partly due to an array of scars and bruises on his olive skin, but more because he was the only stranger in the tavern. He was more disheveled than she'd expected from Emily's swooning, with hair that stuck out every direction in messy clumps and a fresh bruise swelling around one eye. Beneath the table, both of his legs were jogging like a wind-up toy. Three plates were already set out before him, empty but for splatters of grease, bits of egg salad, and untouched slices of tomato and lettuce. She didn't realize she'd been staring at him until his gaze shifted and collided with hers. His eyes were unnaturally green, like sour grapes still on the vine. Scarlett's grip tightened on the plate, and she suddenly understood Emily's swooning. "He has these eyes." Pushing through the crowd, she deposited the sandwich on the table. "You had le croque, monsieur?" "Thank you." His voice startled her, not by being loud or gruff as she'd expected, but rather low and hesitant. Maybe Emily was right. Maybe he really was shy. "Are you sure you don't want us to just bring you the whole pig?" she said, stacking the three empty plates. It would save the servers the trouble of running back and forth from the kitchen. His eyes widened, and for a moment Scarlett expected him to ask if that was an option, but then his attention dipped down to the sandwich. "You have good food here." She withheld a scoff. Good food and Ryu Tavern were two phrases she didn't normally associate with each other. Fighting must work up quite an appetite. He didn't respond. His fingers fidgeted with the straw in his drink, and Scarlett could see the table beginning to shake from his bouncing legs. "Well, enjoy," she said, picking up the dishes. But then she paused and tipped the plates toward him. "Are you sure you don't want the tomatoes? They're the best part, and they were grown in my own garden. The lettuce, too, actually, but it wasn't wilted like this when I harvested it." "Never mind, you don't want the lettuce. But the tomatoes?" Some of the intensity drained from the fighter's face. "I've never tried them." Scarlett arched an eyebrow. "Never?" After a hesitant moment, he released his drinking glass and picked up the two slabs of tomato and shoved them into his mouth. His expression froze mid-chew. He seemed to ponder for a moment, eyes unfixed before swallowing. "Not what I expected," he said, looking up at her again. "But not horrible. I'll order some more of those, if I could." Scarlett adjusted the dishes in her grip, keeping a butter knife from slipping off. "You know, I don't actually work." "Here it comes," said someone near the bar, spurring an excited murmur that rippled through the tavern. Scarlett glanced up at the net screens. They showed a lush garden, flourishing with bamboo and lilies and sparkling from a recent downpour. The red warmth of the ball spilled down a grand staircase. The security camera was above the door, angled toward the long shadows that stretched out into the path. It was beautiful, tranquil. "I have 10 univs that says some girl's about to lose her foot on those stairs," someone shouted, followed by another round of laughter from the bar. "Anyone want to bet me? Come on, what are the odds, really?" A moment later, the cyborg girl appeared on the screen. She bolted from the doorway and down the stairs, shattering the garden's serenity with her billowing silver gown. Scarlett held her breath, knowing what happened next, but she still flinched when the girl stumbled and fell. She crashed down the steps and landed awkwardly at their base, sprawled across the rocky path. Though there was no sound, Scarlett imagined the girl panting as she rolled onto her back and gawked up at the doorway. Shadows cut across the stairs, and a series of unrecognizable figures appeared above her. Having heard the story a dozen times, Scarlett sought out the missing foot still on the stairs, the light from the ballroom glinting off the metal, the girl's cyborg foot. "They say the one on the left is the queen," said Emily. Scarlett jumped, not having heard the waitress approach. The prince, no, the emperor now, crept down the steps and stooped to pick up the foot. The girl reached for the hem of her skirt, tugging it down over her calves, but she couldn't hide the dead tentacle wires dangling from their metal stump. Scarlett knew what the rumors were saying. Not only had the girl been confirmed as a lunar, an illegal fugitive, and a danger to Earth and society, but she'd even managed to brainwash Emperor Kai. Some thought she'd been after power, others riches. Some believed she'd been trying to start the war that had so long been threatened. But no matter what the girl's intentions were, Scarlett couldn't help a twinge of pity. After all, she was only a teenager, younger than Scarlett even, and she looked wholly pathetic, lying at the base of those stairs. "What was that about putting her out of her misery?" said one of the guys at the bar. Roland jutted his finger toward the screen. "Exactly. I've never seen anything so disgusting in my life." Someone near the end leaned forward so he could look around the other patrons at Roland. "I'm not sure I agree. I think she's kind of cute, pretending to be all helpless and innocent like that. Maybe instead of sending her back to the moon, they should let her come stay with me?" He was met with robust laughter. Roland thumped his palm on the bar, rattling a mustard dish. "No doubt that metal leg of hers would make for a real cozy bedmate." "Swine," Scarlett muttered, but her comment was lost in the guffaws. "I wouldn't mind the chance to warm her up," someone new added, and the tables rattled with cheers and amusement. Anger clawed its way back up Scarlett's throat, and she half slammed, half dropped the stack of plates back onto the booth's table. She ignored the startled expressions around her and shoved through the crowd, circling to the back of the bar. The bewildered bartender watched on as Scarlett pushed some liquor bottles out of the way and climbed up onto the counter that stretched the length of the wall. Reaching up, she opened a wall panel beneath a shelf of cognac glasses and plucked out the netlink cable. All three screens went black, the palace garden and cyborg girl vanishing. A roar of protest bellowed up around her. Scarlet spun to face them, accidentally kicking a bottle of wine off the bar. The glass shattered on the floor, but Scarlet barely heard it as she waved the cable at the incense crowd. "You should all have some respect. That girl's going to be executed. That girl's a loner," a woman yelled. "She should be executed." The sentiment was enforced with nods and someone lobbing a crust of bread at Scarlet's shoulder. She planted both hands on her hips. "She's only 16. A brash of arguments roared up, men and women alike clambering to their feet and screaming about lunars and evil, and that girl tried to kill a union leader. "Hey, hey, hey, everyone calm down. Give Scarlet a break," Roland yelled, his confidence bolstered by the whiskey on his breath. He held his hands out toward the jostling crowd. "We all know crazy runs in her family. First that old goose runs off, and now Scar's defending Lunar's rights." A parade of laughter and jeers marched past Scarlet's ears, but were muddled by the sound of her own rushing blood. Without knowing how she'd gotten off the counter, she was suddenly halfway across the bar, bottles and glasses scattering, her fist connecting with Roland's ear. He yelped and spun back to face her. "What? My grandmother's not crazy." She grabbed the front of his shirt. "Is that what you told the detective when he questioned you? Did you tell him she was crazy?" "Of course I told him she was crazy," he yelled back, the stench of alcohol flooding over her. She squeezed the fabric until her fists ached. "And I bet I wasn't the only one. With the way she keeps herself holed up in that old house, talks to animals and androids like they're people, chases folks away with a rifle. One time, and he was an escort salesman. I'm not one tinge surprised that Granny Benoit split her last rocket. Seems to me it's been coming a long while." Scarlet shoved Roland hard with both hands. He stumbled back into Emily, who'd been trying to get in between them. Emily screamed and fell back onto a table in her effort to keep Roland from crushing her. Roland regained his balance, looking like he couldn't decide if he wanted to smirk or snarl. "Better be careful, Scar, or you're going to end up just like the old..." Table legs screeched against the tile, and then the fighter had one hand wrapped around Roland's neck, lifting him clear off the floor. The tavern fell silent. The fighter, unconcerned, held Roland aloft like he was nothing more than a doll, ignoring Roland's gagging. Scarlet gaped, the edge of the bar digging into her stomach. "I believe you owe her an apology," the fighter said in his quiet, even tone. A gurgle slipped out of Roland's mouth. His feet flailed in search of the ground. "Hey, let him go," a man yelled, leaping off his stool. "You're going to kill him." He grasped the fighter's wrist, but he might have grabbed an iron bar for as much as the limb bulged. Flushing, the man let go and pulled back for a punch, but as soon as he swung, the fighter's free hand came up and blocked it. Scarlet staggered back from the bar, duly noting a tattoo of nonsensical letters and numbers stamped across the fighter's forearm. LSOP 962. The fighter still seemed angry, but now there was also the tiniest bit of amusement to his expression, like he just remembered the rules to a game. He eased Roland's feet back to the ground, simultaneously releasing him and the other man's fist. Roland caught his balance on a stool. "What's wrong with you?" he choked out, rubbing his neck. "Are you some lunatic city transplant or something? You were being disrespectful." "Disrespectful?" barked Roland. "You just tried to kill me." Gills erupted from the kitchen, shoving through the swinging doors. "What's going on out here? This guy's trying to start a fight," someone said from the crowd. "And Scarlet broke the screens." "I didn't break them, you idiot," Scarlet yelled, though she wasn't sure who had said it. Gills surveyed the dead screens. Roland still rubbing his neck, the broken bottles and glasses littering the wet floor. He glowered at the street fighter. "You," he said, pointing. "Get out of my tavern." Scarlet's gut tightened. "He didn't do anything." "Don't you start, Scarlet. How much destruction were you planning on causing today? Are you trying to get me to close my account?" She bristled, her face still burning. "Maybe I'll just take back the delivery, and we'll see how your customers like eating spoiled vegetables from now on." Rounding the bar, Gills snatched the cable out of Scarlet's hand. "Do you really think you're the only working farm in France? Honestly, Scar, I only order from you because your grandmother would give me hell if I didn't." Scarlet pursed her lips, holding back the frustrated reminder that her grandmother wasn't here anymore, so maybe he should just order from someone else if that's what he wanted. Gills turned his attention back to the fighter. "I said get out." Ignoring him, the fighter held his hand out to Emily, who was still half curled against the table. Her face was flushed, and her skirt was soaked through with beer, but her gaze glowed with infatuation as she let herself be pulled to her feet. "Thank you," she said, her whisper carrying in the uncanny silence. Finally, the fighter met Gil's scowl. "I will go, but I haven't paid for my meal." He hesitated. "I can pay for the broken glasses as well." Scarlet blinked. "What?" "I don't want your money," Gills screamed, sounding insulted, which came as even further shock to Scarlet, who had only ever heard Gills complain about money and how his vendors were bleeding him dry. "I want you out of my tavern." The fighter's pale eyes darted to Scarlet, and for a moment she sensed a connection between them. Here they were, both outcasts, unwanted, crazy. Pulse thrumming, she buried the thought. This man was trouble. He fought people for a living, or perhaps even for fun. She wasn't sure which was worse. Turning away, the fighter dipped his head in what almost looked like an apology and shuffled toward the exit. Scarlet couldn't help thinking as he passed that despite all signs of brutality, he looked no more menacing now than a scolded dog. Chapter 3. Scarlet pulled the bin of potatoes out from the lowest shelf, dropping it with a thud on the floor before lugging the crate of tomatoes on top. The onions and turnips went beside it. She'd have to make 2 trips out to the ship again, and that made her angrier than anything. So much for a dignified exit. She grabbed the handles of the lower bin and hoisted them up. "Now what are you doing?" Gills said from a doorway, a towel draped over one shoulder. "Taking these back." Heaving a sigh, Gills braced himself against the wall. "Scar, I didn't mean all that out there. I find that unlikely. Look, I like your grandmother, and I like you. Yes, she overcharges, and you can be a used sting in my side, and you're both a little crazy sometimes." He held up both hands defensively when he saw Scarlet's hackles rising. "Hey, you're the one who climbed up on the bar and started making speeches, so don't try to say it's not true." She wrinkled her nose at him. "But when it comes right down to it, your grandmare runs a good farm, and you still grow the best tomatoes in France year after year. I don't want to cancel my account." Scarlet tilted the bin so that the shiny red globes rolled and thumped against one another. "Put them back, Scar. I've already signed off on the delivery payment." He walked away before Scarlet could lose her temper again. Blowing a red curl out of her face, Scarlet set the crates down and kicked the potatoes back to their spot beneath the shelves. She could hear the cooks chortling over the dining room drama. The story had already taken on a legendary air from the waitstaff's telling of it. According to the cooks, the street fighter had broken a bottle over Roland's head, knocking him unconscious and crushing a chair in the process. He would have taken out Gills, too, if Emily hadn't calmed him down with one of her pretty smiles. With no interest in correcting the story, Scarlett dusted her hands on her jeans and paced back into the kitchen. A coldness hung in the air between her and the tavern staff as she made her way to the scanner beside the back door. Gills was nowhere to be seen, and Emily's giggles could be heard out in the dining room. Scarlett hoped she was only imagining the dropped glances. She wondered how fast the rumors would spread through town. Scarlett Benoit was defending the cyborg, the Lunar. She's clearly split her rocker, just like her, just like. She swiped her wrist beneath the ancient scanner. Out of habit, she inspected the delivery order that appeared on the screen, making sure Gills hadn't shortened her like he often tried, and noting that he had, in fact, deducted 3 units for the smashed tomatoes. 687U deposited to vendor account Benoit Farms and Gardens. She left through the back door without saying goodbye to anyone. Though still warm from the sunny afternoon, the shadows of the alley were refreshing compared with the sweltering kitchen, and Scarlett let it cool her down while she reorganized the crates in the back of the ship. She was behind schedule. It would be late evening before she got home. She would have to get up extra early to go to the Toulouse police station. Otherwise, she would lose a whole day in which no one was doing anything to recover her grandmother. 2 weeks. 2 whole weeks of her grandmother being out there alone, helpless, forgotten, maybe even dead, maybe kidnapped and killed and left in a dark, wet ditch somewhere. And why? Frustrated tears steamed her eyes, but she blinked them back. Slamming the hatch, she rounded to the front of the ship and froze. The fighter was there, his back against the stone building, watching her. In her surprise, a hot tear leaked out. She swiped at it before it could crawl halfway down her cheek. She returned his stare, calculating if his stance was threatening or not. He stood a dozen steps from the nose of her ship, and his expression seemed more hesitant than dangerous. But then, it hadn't seemed dangerous when he nearly strangled Roland either. "I wanted to make sure you were all right," he said, his voice almost lost in the jumbled noise from the tavern. She splayed her fingers on the back of the ship, annoyed at how her nerves were humming, like they couldn't decide if she should be afraid of him or flattered. "I'm better off than Roland," she said. "His neck was already starting to bruise when I left." His eyes flashed toward the kitchen door. He deserved worse. She would have smiled, but she didn't have the energy after biting back all the anger and frustration of the afternoon. "I wish you hadn't gotten involved at all. I had the situation under control." Clearly, he squinted at her like he was trying to figure out a puzzle. "But I was worried you might draw that gun on him, and such a scene may not have helped your case, as far as not being crazy, that is." Hair prickled behind her neck, Scarlett's hand instinctively went to her lower back, where a small pistol was warm against her skin. Her grandma had given it to her on her 11th birthday, with the paranoid warning, "You just never know when a stranger will want to take you somewhere you don't mean to go." She taught Scarlett to use it, and Scarlett hadn't left home without it since, no matter how ridiculous and unnecessary it seemed. 7 years later, and she was quite sure not a single person had ever noticed the gun concealed under her usual red hoodie, until now. "How did you know?" He shrugged, or would have been a shrug if the movement hadn't been so tense and jerky. "I saw the handle when you climbed up on the counter." Scarlett lifted the back of her sweatshirt just enough to loosen the pistol from her waistband. She tried to take in a calming breath, but the air was filled with onion and garbage stink of the alley. "Thanks for your concern, but I'm just fine. I have to go behind on the deliveries, behind on everything. She stepped toward the pilot's door. Do you have any more tomatoes? She paused. The fighter shrank back further into the shadows, looking sheepish. I'm still a little hungry, he muttered. Scarlet imagined she could smell the tomato flesh on the wall behind her. I can pay, he quickly added. She shook her head. No, that's all right. We have plenty. She shuffled backward, keeping her eyes on him, and reopened the hatch. She grabbed a tomato and a bundle of crooked carrots. Here, these are good raw, too, she said, tossing them to him. He caught them with ease, the tomato disappearing in his large fist and his other hand gripping the carrots by their lacy, leafy stems. He surveyed them from every angle. What are they? A surprised laugh tumbled out of her. They're carrots. Are you serious? Again, he seemed embarrassingly aware of having said something unusual. His shoulders hunched in a vain attempt to make himself even smaller. Thank you. Your mom never made you eat your vegetables, did she? Their gazes clashed, and the awkwardness was immediate. Something shattered inside the tavern, making Scarlet jump. It was followed by the roar of laughter. Never mind, they're good. You'll like them. She shut the hatch and rounded to the door again, whisking her ID across the ship's scanner. The door opened, forming a wall between them, and the floodlights blinked on. They accentuated the bruise around the fighter's eye, making it seem darker than before. He flinched back like a criminal in a spotlight. I was wondering you could use a farmhand, he said, the word slur in his rush to get them out. Scarlet paused, suddenly understanding why he'd waited for her, why he stalled so long. She scanned his broad shoulders, bulky arms. He was built for manual labor. You're looking for work? He started to smile, a look that was dangerously mischievous. The money's good at the fights, but it doesn't make for much of a career. I thought maybe you could pay me in food. She laughed. After seeing the evidence of your appetite in there, I think I'd lose my shirt with a deal like that. She flushed the second she said it. No doubt he was now imagining her with her shirt off. Yet to her shock, his face remained serenely neutral, and she hurried to fill the space before his reactions caught up. What's your name anyway? That awkward shrug again. They call me Wolf at the fights. Wolf? How predatory. He nodded, entirely serious. Scarlet swallowed a grin. You might want to leave the street fighter bit off your resume. He scratched at his elbow, where the strange tattoo could barely be seen in the dark, and she thought maybe she'd embarrassed him. Perhaps Wolf was a beloved nickname. Well, they call me Scarlet. Yes, like the hair. What a clever observation. His expression softened. What hair? Scarlet settled her arm on top of the door, resting her chin. Good one. For a moment, he seemed almost pleased with himself, and Scarlet found herself warming to this stranger, this anomaly, this soft-spoken street fighter. A warning tingled in the back of her head. She was wasting time. Her grandmother was out there, alone, frightened, dead in a ditch. Scarlet tightened her grip on the doorframe. I'm really sorry, but we have a full staff already. I don't need any more farmhands. The glint faded from his eyes, and in an instant he was looking uncomfortable again, flustered. I understand. Thank you for the food. He kicked at the stem of a dead firework on the pavement, a remnant from last night's peace celebration. You should head to Toulouse, or even Paris. There are more jobs in the cities, and people around here don't take too kindly to strangers, as you may have noticed. He tilted his head so that his emerald eyes glowed even brighter in the wash of the ship's floodlights, looking almost amused. Thanks for the tip. Turning, Scarlet sank into the pilot's seat. Wolf shifted toward the wall as she started the engine. If you change your mind about needing a hand, I can be found at the abandoned Morrell House most nights. I may not be great with people, but I think I'd do well on a farm. Amusement touched the corners of his lips. Animals love me. Oh, I'm sure they do, Scarlet said, beaming with fake encouragement. She shut the door before muttering, What farm animals don't love a wolf? Chapter 4. The captivity of Carswell Thorne had gotten off to a rocky start, what with the catastrophic soap rebellion and all. But since being transferred to solitary, he'd become a personification of a well-mannered gentleman, and after 6 months of such commendable behavior, he persuaded the only female guard on rotation to lend him a port screen. He was quite sure this would not have succeeded if the guard wasn't convinced he was an idiot, incapable of doing anything other than counting the days and searching for naughty pictures of ladies he'd known and imagined. And she was right, of course. Thorne was mystified by technology and couldn't have done anything useful with the tablet, even if he had had a step-by-step instruction manual on how to escape from jail using a port screen. He'd been unsuccessful in accessing his comms, connecting to news feeds, or scouting out any information on New Beijing Prison and the surrounding city. But he sure did appreciate the suggestively naughty, if heavily filtered, pictures. He was scrolling through his portfolio on the 228th day of his captivity, wondering if Senora Santiago was still married to that onion-smelling man, when an awful screeching disrupted the cell's peacefulness. He peered upward, squinting at the smooth, glossy white ceiling. The sound ceased and was followed by shuffling, a couple thuds, more grinding. Thorne folded his legs atop his cot and waited while the noise grew louder and closer, hiccuped, and continued. It took him some time to place this new strange noise, but after much listening and pondering, he was convinced it was the sound of a motorized drill. Maybe one of the other prisoners was remodeling. The sound stopped, though the memory of it lingered, vibrating off the walls. Thorne glanced around. His cell was a perfect cube with smooth, shiny white panels on all six sides. It contained his all-white cot, a urinal that slid in and out of the wall with the press of a button, and him in his white uniform. If someone was remodeling, he hoped his cell would be next. The sound started again, more grating this time, and then a long screw punctured through the ceiling and clattered to the center of the cell's floor. Three more dropped after it. Thorne craned his head as one of the screws rolled beneath his cot. A moment later, a square tile fell from the ceiling with a bang, followed by two dangling legs and a startled cry. The legs wore a white cotton jumpsuit that matched Thorne's, but unlike his own plain white shoes, the feet attached to those legs were bare. One wore skin, the other a plating of reflective metal. With a grunt, the girl released her hold on the ceiling and fell into a crouch in the middle of the cell. Resting his elbows on his knees, Thorne tilted forward, trying to get a better look at her without moving from his safe position against the wall. She had a slight build and tan skin and straight brown hair. Like her left foot, her left hand was made of metal. Stabilizing herself, the girl stood and brushed off her jumpsuit. "I'm sorry," Thorne said. She spun toward him, eyes wild. "It seems that you stumbled into the wrong jail cell. Do you need directions to get back to yours?" She blinked. Thorne smiled. The girl frowned. Her irritation made her prettier, and Thorne cupped his chin, studying her. He'd never met a cyborg before, much less flirted with one. But there was a first time for everything. "These cells aren't supposed to be occupied," she said. "Special circumstances." She surveyed him for a long moment, her brows knitting together. "Murder?" His grin grew. "Thank you, but no. I started a riot on the yard. He adjusted his collar before adding, "We were protesting the soap." Her confusion grew, and Thorne noticed that she was still in her defensive stance. "The soap," he said again, wondering if she'd heard him. "It's too drying." She said nothing. "I have sensitive skin." Her mouth opened, and he expected sympathy, but all that came out was a disinterested, "Huh." Drawing herself up, she kicked the fallen ceiling tile out from beneath her feet, then proceeded to turn in a full circle, surveying the cell. Her lips curled in annoyance. "Stupid," she muttered, nearing the wall to Thorne's left and placing a palm against it. "One room off." Her eyelashes suddenly fluttered as if dust were stuck in them. Growling, she smacked her palm against her temple a few times. "You're escaping." "Not at this very moment," she said through her teeth, roughly shaking her head. "But yes, that is the general idea." Her face lit up when she spotted the port in his lap. "What model port screen is that?" "I haven't the faintest idea." He held it up for her. "I'm putting together a portfolio of the women I've loved." Pushing herself from the wall, she snatched the port screen away and flipped it over. A tip of her cyborg finger opened, revealing a small screwdriver. It wasn't long before she'd undone the plate on the underside of the port. "What are you doing?" "Taking your vid cable." "What for?" "Mine's on the fritz." She pulled a yellow wire from the screen and dropped it back into Thorne's lap, then sank cross-legged to the floor. Thorne watched, mystified, as she tossed her hair to one side and unlatched a panel at the base of her skull. A moment later, fingers emerged with a wire similar to the one she'd just stolen from him, but with one blackened end. The girl's face contorted in concentration while she installed the new cable. With a pleased sigh, she shut the panel and tossed the old cable next to Thorne. "Thanks." He grimaced, shrinking away from the wire. "You have a port screen in your head?" "Something like that." The girl stood and ran a hand over the wall again. "Ah, that's much better. Now how do I..." Trailing off, she pushed the button in the corner. A glossy white panel slid up into the wall, ejecting the urinal with smooth precision. Her fingers fished into the gap left between the fixture and the wall, searching. Inching away from the neglected cable on the cot, Thorne cleared his mind of the image of her opening a plate in her skull, once again calling up the personification of a gentleman, and attempted to make small talk while she worked. He asked what she was in for and complimented the fine workmanship of her metal extremities, but she ignored him, making him briefly question if he'd been separated from the female population for so long that he could be losing his charm. But that seemed unlikely. A few minutes later, the girl seemed to find what she was looking for, and Thorne heard the motorized drill sound again. "When they locked you up," Thorne said, "didn't they consider that this prison might have some security weaknesses?" "It didn't at the time. This hand is kind of a new addition." She paused and stared hard at one corner of the alcove, as if trying to see through the wall. Maybe she had X-ray vision. Now that he could find some good uses for. "Let me guess," Thorne said, "breaking and entering?" After a long silence of examining the retracting mechanism, the girl wrinkled her nose. "Two counts of treason, if you must know, and resisting arrest, and unlawful use of bioelectricity. Oh, and illegal immigration, but I think that's a little excessive." He squinted at the back of her head, a twitch developing in his left eye. "How old are you?"
16.
The screwdriver in her hand began to spin again. Thorne waited until there was a lull in the grinding. "What's your name?"
"Cinder,"
she said, followed by another swell of noise. When it died down, "I'm Captain Carswell Thorne, but usually people just call me more grinding. Thorne, or Captain Thorne.